Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
The way of the Lord.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. Today we reflect on both the forthcoming feast of the martyrdom of St. John the Baptist on the 29th of August and on the death of an Iraqi priest who was killed in June of this year. We look at the contribution of Benedictine monks to education and learning across the centuries and the ending of the British involvement in transatlantic slavery.
Ces hommes, ces femmes, ces enfants ont été victimes.
These men, these women, these children, who were victims of a shameful commerce, of whom some were baptized people, but who had no true life for their faith, how can we forget the enormous suffering, the contempt for the most elementary human rights, inflicted on the deported populations of the African continent? How can we forget the lives annihilated by slavery?
Pope John Paul II visited Gorée, an island off the coast of Senegal, in February 1992. Shocked by all that he saw and heard of Gorée's historical role in the transportation of slaves across the oceans, he spoke of the black sorrow of the island. He prayed for an end to all violence and injustice between all peoples.
Pour achever cette rencontre, au terme de notre prière universelle,
in terms of our universal prayer, we invoke Mary, Mother of Mercy, in our profound regret for past sins, in particular for those that we recall in this place. We ask her to be our advocate close to her son. We beg her that violence and injustice between men will cease, that no longer will burial pits of hatred and vengeance be dug, but rather that respect, peace and friendship will make progress between all peoples.
Mais que progresse le respect, la concorde, l'amitié entre tous les peuples.
There are many tragic memories of slavery. The Merseyside Maritime Museum has a splendid exhibition showing Liverpool's involvement in the transatlantic slave trade. One of the exhibits is a road sign for Gorée Piazzas, a place off the Dock Road, near the pierhead. I and many other Liverpudlians remember seeing large metal rings in the walls of the piazzas, rings reputedly used to fasten the slaves when they landed in Liverpool. Yet, Gorée Piazzas were only built 11 years after the abolition of slavery in Britain. As Tony Tibbles, keeper of the museum, comments, slaves never actually arrived in Liverpool.
Well, they never actually came to Liverpool. Very few of them did, because what happened was that the goods were taken out to Africa. The ships then went from Africa direct to across the Atlantic, to the Caribbean or to Brazil. And they only came back to Liverpool when they were empty, or rather when they were bringing goods back, so that they were only carried on that middle passage.
It would seem that the metal rings, which, according to local folklore, were used to fasten slaves, were probably utilised for tying horses. Yet there was an association with Gorée and slavery, as Tony Tibbles continues.
Well, one of the streets in Liverpool was named Gorée, and there were also some warehouses that were built just behind the pierhead, which were called the Gorée Warehouses, and the area behind them is called the Gorée Piazza. Now, that's clearly named after the island off Dakar, and I still don't really know why it was called that, but clearly it is named after Gorée. But it's strange because Dakar, Senegal, Gorée were part of the sort of French area of influence, and very few Liverpool ships actually went to Gorée to trade. There's only, you know, a handful of ships, but there's also a ship called the Gorée Packet. So there clearly was a link between Liverpool and Gorée in the mid-18th century. But the exact nature of it, we don't know. But, I mean, it's one of the things that you can see around the city that remind you of the association with the slave trade, and you know, not everybody realises that. And one of the things that we're trying to do is to make those links for people.
And those links are very important. Without looking back in order to see what happened in the past, it is very difficult to create a positive future. The Merseyside Maritime Museum has a very impressive display in which great efforts are made to educate visitors about the slave trade.
Well, this exhibition, this gallery, has now been open for over 10 years. And in the way of, you know, museum displays, things that we did 10 years ago are now out of date to a certain extent. And I mean, it's actually still looking very good, but things don't last forever.
Time moves on. 2007 marks the 200th anniversary of the abolition of the slave trade in Britain. How can a museum help with slavery awareness today?
The gallery deals very well with the historic story of transatlantic slavery. What we weren't able to do because of lack of space was explore the consequences of slavery, the legacy of it. And a lot of people, particularly in the local black community, but other people as well, have been saying, we think that you ought to be doing more in terms of telling that story, making links with today. And that's particularly important for educational reasons. We do quite a lot of work with schools, for instance, in terms of the national curriculum, in terms of citizenship. And this is one of the places that they can come to and see aspects of citizenship which link through to the black community, to issues of racism and discrimination.
What are the future? Tony Tibbles looks ahead to the bicentenary.
What we're planning is a new, in fact, international slavery museum, which is going to be about 2.5 times the size of the present gallery. It's going to occupy the whole of one floor of this building, and that's going to open on International Slavery Day, which is the 23rd of August. And what we will be doing is redisplaying the gallery, but also widening the sorts of areas that we're dealing with in terms of looking very much at those legacies of the slave trade. And we're looking at issues of racism and discrimination, of global inequality that have not all global inequality obviously relates back to the slave trade, but we want to make people aware of the links that there are. But we also want to look at elements of cultural transformation, how that diaspora of people from Africa has had such an influence on the culture and societies in both the Americas and in Europe.
Slavery has been a part of many civilizations throughout history. It continues today through human trafficking across the world. Today there might not be slave ships as in past centuries, but that is only because of the progress of technology that has made available other forms of transport, other forms of enslavement. Pope Benedict pointed out to the diplomatic corps accredited to the Holy See on January the 9th, 2006, that truth can only be attained in freedom.
L'engagement pour la vérité donne fondement et vigueur au droit à la liberté.
Truth can only be attained in freedom. This is the case with all truth, as is clear from the history of science, but it is eminently the case with those truths in which man himself, man is such, is at stake. The truths of the spirit, the truths about good and evil, about the great goals and horizons of life, about our relationship with God. These truths cannot be attained without profound consequences for the way we live our lives. And once freely appropriated, they demand in return an ample sphere of freedom if they are to be lived out in a way befitting every dimension of human life. In the development of international law today, it is becoming increasingly clear that no government can feel free to neglect its duty to ensure suitable conditions of freedom for its own citizens without thereby damaging its credibility to speak out on international problems. And rightly so, for in safeguarding the rights belonging to the person as such, rights which are internationally guaranteed, one must naturally give primary importance to ensuring the rights of freedom within individual states, in public and private life, in economic and political relations, and in the cultural and religious spheres.
We are all in search of freedom and truth. Governments have a duty to facilitate that search. Benedictines throughout the ages have been associated with learning and education, and in fact preserved learning throughout the Dark Ages. Abbot Edmund Power is the abbot of St. Paul's outside the walls in Rome. He explains.
That again, I'd say, is a function of the stability. You can see how rich the concept of stability is, because in fact, any form, I would say, any form of culture, whether it be art, music, literature, requires a stable context in which people can actually develop their capacity, their concrete gifts of making the art, but also can reflect on what they want to convey. In other words, art seems to spring from that context of stability. Now, I know some might disagree. Tension within a person, I would say, division or tension within an individual person can generate great art as a response to that as well. But the Benedictine monastery was a stable social unit and ideally a very selfless social unit. Its purpose was not commercial success. St. Benedict, in fact, says in the rule, very concretely, if the monks make things and to sell, let them sell them at a price slightly less than what they're sold in the marketplace, to overcome the temptation to just make money for the sake of making money. So that there are these stable units of people dedicated to a spiritual search, dedicated to order in the sense of organization, clear cosmos rather than chaos, and of course this is the whole creative work of God is bringing order to the chaos. It's a reflection of that, and in that context they were obviously intelligent people. They had the time to actually study, to consider, to reflect, to write, and that became the kind of the nest in which classical culture was preserved.
In fact, the stability and order of the Benedictine community was seen as a possible model for the unification and direction for the fractured Europe of the Dark Ages.
Because there was chaos all around in those early centuries after the collapse of the Roman Empire. Europe sort of fragmented and the monasteries were points of stability, points of light in the darkness, which is maybe why the Benedictine rule, I've said it's very valuable in itself, but it also had very powerful political exponents. It was a political decision in a way. You could say that the Emperor Charlemagne, for example, I'm not a great historian of the period, but that the decision by people like him to disseminate the Benedictine way of life throughout his lands was maybe a conscious attempt to create culture, yes, but also to impose an order, because if the Benedictine rule was the basic norm for monasteries throughout a large area, then it was like a European constitution in a way. You could say St. Benedict is the European, that Benedictine life or Benedictinism is the father or the mother of the whole European idea of today, which is basically trying to create something similar to what exists in the Roman period. You had all of Europe under one rule. I'm not saying that it wants to be a new European empire, but living in harmony with our different ways of looking at things. That It is quite interesting the way it does relate to Benedictine, the Benedictine, or the use made of the Benedictine rule in the centuries following the time of Benedict.
The preservation of great works of learning, exquisitely and painstakingly copied out, could not have happened outside the context of a place where there was the time, love, and care to lavish upon the creation of works of beauty. Abbot Edmund describes a precious, illuminated Bible in the care of his own community.
Yeah, the whole art of writing, we know printing began in the 15th century, but the whole art of writing by hand, which was developed in the monasteries, the monks had the time, you know, and would sit with enormous patience. Benedict talks about patience being a primary virtue of the Benedictine life. He's thinking primarily of the tolerance with which you accept the weaknesses of others, which, if you do that, if you lovingly accept the moral and physical weaknesses of others, he says, you know, this is a way in which you yourself will grow in sanctity, which is very good. But this patience also would overflow maybe into your approach to your work. So if you're doing a work like illuminated manuscripts, we've got at the Monastery of St. Paul here in Rome what's called the Carolingian Bible, the Bible of St. Paul's outside the walls. It's a huge handwritten Bible dating from probably the early 9th century. It was done in France. It's not clear exactly who did it. It's full of illuminated images and so on, with an exquisite writing. And it was given by maybe it was roughly the time of Charlemagne. It was given to the Pope, who passed it on very quickly as a gift to the monks of St. Paul's, where it's been ever since. But when you look at it, you think, goodness, how many years did that take to write? You know, every letter is perfectly formed by hand, you know, in a beautiful script, the whole Bible written with these wonderful illuminated images of from the gospel scenes. And you realise that this is the fruit of a profound stability, of a profound patience, of a sense of time that's not rushed, that life is a gift and you just move slowly through it. It's a very impressive sort of witness, I think, of what the Benedictine spirit can produce.
There is a sense of history and stability that comes about as a result of living in the 1300-year-old monastery of St. Paul's outside the walls. It gives strength and context to monastic living, but it can also be a mixed blessing.
Yeah, the longest, the oldest monasteries are as continuous institutions, because there are monasteries in many parts of the world and many of them are very old, but some of them were closed or destroyed because of political circumstances, like in France, for example, at the time of the Revolution and so on. The monasteries of Austria, for example, have had a continuous life right through, and out of Switzerland, going way back into the, you know, 8th, 9th centuries. And St. Paul's as well, in the 720, we think 720, clear, the Benedictine monastery from that date. We've got the list of all the abbots from about the year 900 onwards. I must be the 280th or something, I don't know. Haven't counted, actually. But there is this sense of continuity and of fidelity to a tradition. It gives you a strength. It gives you a very kind of, it gives you a context from which you can move forward into the future, because we can't live in the past. We've got to live in the present and look to the future. This is a great strength behind us. At the same time, it can be an awful burden, you know, because a sense of responsibility to the past, or to a glorious past that no longer exists, or to a past encapsulated in an architectural ethos. You know, imagine some of these huge Baroque monasteries of the former Habsburg Empire and so on, and you think there's not all that many monks left live nowadays, because there aren't the number of monks that there were. And you think that must be a terrible burden for someone, you know, to feel I've got this huge thing, we've got to carry it forward, and there's only 10 of us, you know. You know, it can be flattening. But so it's a mixed blessing, I think, the sense of a long history.
At the end of the day, however, a Benedictine community is a family in which every monk has a place.
Yeah, that's quite important, and it very much reflects St. Paul's own theology, you know, of the body. You know, the body has different members, and you know, not everybody can be a toe or a thumb. He doesn't actually say that explicitly, but and the same in the monastery. You know, I think the way to see it is that we all contribute to the well-being of the community, and as a result of the well-being of the community, we can help others. Who might come. It's not a selfish, inward-looking thing. But and there's different responsibilities. You know, someone has to be abbot. It's not an easy job, but someone has to be it. Someone has to be, someone has to do the garden. You could say the garden's more important than the abbot, you know, especially if the garden's producing the food. But everybody should rejoice in their own job, and do it with love and dedication, and that is their way to sanctity, as part of their monastic journey.
Prepare the way of the Lord.
Prepare ye the way of the Lord. These words of John the Baptist led to his execution at the hands of an unjust tyrant. Father Richard Taylor, who teaches New Testament studies at both the Pontifical Beda College and at the Angelicum University in Rome, shows us that the example of John the Baptist is also an example given by one of today's newest martyrs.
That's one of the most tragic episodes, put marvellously well in chapter 6. Of the Gospel of Mark. The story, if you remember, is a banquet at which the daughter of Herodias dances, and the king says that he will give her anything she wants as a reward for the happiness she has just given him. And then she goes to her mother, and she asks the mother what she should ask the king for. And the mother, in lapidary fashion, said, "The head of John the Baptist now." So the girl goes to the king, and she says, "I want the head of John the Baptist on a dish." So the story goes that the king is presented as being sorry and afraid of losing face, and the executioner goes, and the story is told in such a very subdued way, as though somehow or other there's no emotion in it at all. But it's suffused with emotion, because John the Baptist is not presented in the text as having any say in his own fate. And nobody cried.
Except Jesus.
Later. But in the actual text, you can see that effectively his head is cut off in the prison, it's brought on a dish, it's given to the girl, and the girl gives it to her mother. And then, on hearing of it, the disciples of John the Baptist came, and they took his body and laid it in a tomb. One of the most tragic and most poignantly told stories in the whole of the New Testament. And the death of John the Baptist is obviously the death of a marvellous man. So good, removed by a tyrant for the most seemingly trivial reasons. But of course it wasn't trivial, because John the Baptist had held up moral standards in the face of ultimate death, and he had proclaimed them and died for them. Now that's why, in a sense, you can never hear of a martyrdom in the interests of what is true and good without recalling the way in which John the Baptist bore witness to the values that he had received from God through the Old Testament.
Because his death was as a result of pure self-interest.
Well, basically, it had a major political implication, because if John the Baptist had continued to proclaim that the king is not upholding the law, well, then, of course, the people hearing John the Baptist are more than likely to take their distance from the king. So it is self-interest, self-protection, but self-protection of a tyrant for tyranny. So you could appreciate that there was a political implication of a most profound importance. And it also anticipated in its delineation with the way in which Jesus himself would die. Once again, proclaiming in public what is the case, saying it all the time, preferring to die than retract, and ultimately being martyred for what he said. So we see John the Baptist is going in always in tandem with Jesus in the minds of the people who presented the Baptist episode in the Gospels.
And the thing is that the martyrdom of John the Baptist, if you take out the actual details of his death, the reasons for his death are as relevant today, 2,000 years later, as they were then.
You're absolutely right. And you can take the tragic event the other day of the death of Father Ragid Ghani, who, as a priest with his own people in Iraq, had every opportunity to leave Iraq and find either a place outside his own country or in a way that wouldn't involve giving public attestation to the values that he held. But he refused to leave and told everybody that he would stay with them, that the pastor would be with his flock. He would not abandon them. And as you can see, he paid the highest price. And with him were his immediate entourage, the deacons who were singled out and assassinated with him. So people would rightly consider Ragid as a martyr figure, bearing witness to the values of the kingdom of God in the most dreadful circumstances and knowing the implications for doing so.
Which demanded a tremendous amount of courage.
See, he was very, very courageous and had the strength, and also in you read now the actual communications that he made shortly before he died, the nature of his priestly and Christian commitment. He knew what he was doing, and he also was hoping that his fidelity to the faith would have an encouraging and sustaining effect for all the faithful who needed him, because they needed a focus to help them, what with their churches being bombed, with the destruction of everything that was near and dear to them around, for one sole reason, that they were actually Christians. That was the only reason they were being persecuted. And so he decided to honour his vocation, absolutely, and paid the ultimate price. So it's wonderfully impressive.
And you are in a very special position of knowing a martyr.
That's right, because I had, with others, taught him for 2 years in the ecumenical programme in the Angelicum University, and was certainly part of the exam team when he actually took his licence, so I knew him quite well. He was the most personable and kindly and accessible gentleman, and this has been attested also recently in this lovely letter written from the Muslim professor in the Gregorian University, who published a letter which now is available to everyone on how it is possible for a Muslim and a Catholic to share the same values and to look on life in the same way. And in fact, this professor would see Ragid as being a martyr for the Christian cause. We mustn't forget the people who died with him and all the other people who are effectively paying a great price for the simple fact of being faithful Catholics.
And so we come to the end of our programme for today. You can hear it all again in whole or in its parts if you go to our website at www.vaticanradio.org/English. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
This is the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.